So just using the script analysis, we can push him back a good 150 years. So therefore, what manuscripts are then available to us? Well, we found two others. One is right there in the British Library, which I'm going to be studying next month, and that is the Mu'il, the 2165 manuscript. Now, this uses an earlier script, a Hijazi script, and it uses a third school of the Hijazi script called the Mu'il, which is a slanted script. That would have been around in the 7th century. This particular manuscript has been dated to 790, again, late 8th century. Now, to this date, no one knows whether or not it's complete. We don't know whether or not it has manuscript variants. No one studied it. We're going to study it for the first time. But we have an even earlier manuscript, which is known as the Sana manuscript, which is proving to be the most troubling for Muslims. The Sana manuscripts were discovered in 1975, and when they were discovered in 75, they did not know how to read many of the scripts on them, and so they flew down to a German scriptologist, who probably the most renowned in the world today, Dr. Gerd Quinn and Dr. von Bothmer, out of Saarland University in Saarbrücken in Western Germany, in 1981, to look at them, and they took pictures of all the pages of the manuscripts, and those pictures were then confiscated. The microfilms were confiscated by the Yemeni government, and were only released to them in 1997. That means they've only had 4 years to look at them. In the last 4 years, they found an awful lot that has proved very troubling. What they find now is that an awful lot of the surahs are missing. You can show me, and I went to see Dr. Gerd Quinn last year, a year and a half ago, and he showed me the facsimile of the manuscript that finally was released to him in 1997, and he shows me Surah 19 suddenly jumps to Surah 22. What happened to Surah 20, 21? And it jumps halfway down the page. If it had been at the bottom of the page, you could say the pops of goat ate it, or it got lost, or it got burned, or something. But the fact that it jumps halfway down the page shows it was not there at the very beginning, certainly not when this manuscript was written, and they've been able to date this by looking at the script again, the script analysis, they've been able to date this manuscript to the early 8th century. Again, a good 60 years after the time, supposedly, when Uthman canonized it using Zayd ibn Thabit, Alas, Harith, and Zubair. Now that is a good 60 years later, and still it's not complete. What is most curious is what they have found, and I have to be careful, I can't say too much yet because he hasn't published it. So I'm going to stop right there, because if I say any more, especially in a public audience like this, and it gets recorded, it'll get back to Gerd Quinn, and I have to be careful that I don't say what he's going to be publishing. But you need to pray for this, because this needs to be published, and people need to read this and realize that much of the claims that the Muslims make for their manuscripts, for their earliest Qurans, are now proving to be false. But whereas we have always known this and always surmised and always assumed this was the case, we never had any manuscript evidence to support what we knew. Now the manuscripts are coming to the fore. All right. He says we're going to think we're the Jesus Seminar for Islam. Or the Muhammad Seminar for Islam. Whatever, yeah. But certainly we aren't putting little beads in here and there to find out which is true or not. We're looking at them because of our own preconceived ideas. We've got manuscript evidence to support what we're saying, and that's a big difference. All right? What are the best history books to explain Islam the first 200 years? Probably the best one that's good for laymen to read is Islam, Its Beliefs and Practices by Andrew Rippon. Andrew Rippon is a professor from Calgary, and he has taken and looked at the history of Islam, but not only has he looked at the traditions and try to follow what the traditions have said, that's the Sira, and the Tafsir, and the Hadith, and the Tahriq, especially the Tahriq. But he has also looked and brought in an awful lot of the historical criticism into that. So he's trying to meld the two together, which is a very difficult job, and he's trying to do it in layman's terminology so everybody can understand. And that's probably the best book I can think. Josh, do you know any others off the top of your head? What's a good one on the history of Islam for the first 200 years? Probably Hawtings. Yeah, the one I just said. Muslim Volume 1. What did I say? I'm sorry, I got the title completely wrong. It's Muslims Volume 1, not Islam Volume 1. Did I say Islam? Good man, make sure you're not sleeping next time. Here's my authority over here. Okay, Muslims Volume 1 by Andrew Rippon. Okay, It's Beliefs and Practices. That's probably the best one. How about F.E. Peters? That would be another one you could probably go to. Or G.R. Hawtin, The First Century of Islam, is another one that you can go to. Hawting, who's my professor at SOAS, School of Oriental and African Studies in London. Martin Ling's on the earliest sources. Okay. If you also want to go and look at on our website at Is the Quran the Word of God, look at my bibliography. There's about 80 books you can read there. I can't think what they are at the top of my head. Any of those books would be fine. There is no one model that I can give you, obviously, and I wouldn't have the audacity to say that I have something that's going to help in every situation. What I will say is that almost any discussion you do have with a Muslim sooner or later is going to come back to revelation. It almost always comes back to revelation. Whether or not you try to get into talk about prophets, whether or not you talk about who God is, how you define him, what his character is, whether or not you're going to talk about heaven or hell or even the whole tradition of the prophets or even who Jesus is, you're going to have to go back to your scriptures to substantiate what you're saying. They're going to have to go back to their scriptures to substantiate what they're saying. And invariably, as soon as you quote your scriptures, if you want to go to the Trinity, for instance, or if you want to go to the sons of Jesus Christ, as soon as you use your scriptures as reference, they're going to stop you and say, we cannot use it. It's not trustworthy because it's been corrupted. And this is what you get over and over and over again. Every Muslim I've talked to will not adhere to what I believe in my scriptures because they know it's been corrupted. Now, I'm curious, and I find it certainly you need to deal with that question before you even get on to the next one, because it comes up over and over again. The best way I know how to answer that is twofold. First of all, I'll take them back to their own Quran to show that they cannot say that. And I'll take them back to Surah and Ayahs, such as Surah 1094 and Surah 21:7, both of which say, if you have any questions, go to the Christians, go to the people of the book, for they have been given the signs. Or Surah 29:46, do not argue with the Christians, for they have been given the scriptures before you. They're not to argue with us. And I use that at Speaker's Corner all the time. And then if that doesn't work, then I'll take them back to Surah 4:136, which tells Muslims to come to our scriptures to find that which is written there. Or Surah 5:68, which tells me as a Christian to take my scriptures and use it as a guide to understand that which God has given. So these are the scriptures I will go to because it's their authority. Starting with their authority, I will show that they have no right to condemn my scriptures because nowhere in their scriptures does it condemn my scriptures. I can't find in the Quran any place which speaks of a corruption of the earlier scriptures. In fact, it doesn't even warn them of this. Now, there are some references to the Jews hiding the scriptures. That's not corruption of scriptures. That's the Jews hiding it so Muslims cannot read it. What is interesting, I don't find any reference to a corruption of scriptures in the Hadith or the Sirah or the Tafsir or the Tahriq or the Tabakat, any of the Islamic traditions. It does not exist in the 8th or 9th or 10th century. It finally gets introduced in 1056 by a man named Ibn Hazm. That's the 11th century. That's 400 years after the fact. It takes them 400 years to finally document that perhaps our scriptures are corrupted. So that's where you need to start. Start with that. Show them that, listen, if they have any questions, come to us. They're to come to us, can ask us. And then move right into the gospel. That's my first spiritual law. Go ahead.
Hi, Jim. My name's Terry.
Hi, Terry.
Hi. About a year and a half ago, I was talking to a Muslim, and I said I wanted to get down to the bottom of this, so I asked him, do you or any members of your sect or group believe in violence? And of course he said no. But by the time we got around to the conversation, an hour later, I'd asked him, what do you do about gays? What do you do about child molesters? He said, well, I'll shoot him myself and go to prison as an honor. So what I want to know is, what group would he fall into? He was a Middle Eastern Muslim. We just talked at Denny's one day. And also, it's kind of along the same lines as what that lady said. I'm starting a telephone ministry starting with the A's in the telephone book, and I'm already hitting Muslims. So how can I start the conversation when I do call these people cold turkey?
Two questions again. Yeah, the first one, I think we need to be careful because certainly when they say they don't believe in violence, they mean that. They don't believe in violence as they see it. Violence against people, violence against persons, or violence where it's unheeded. What he's referring to, that he will kill the gays, not all Muslims believe that. I don't know. In fact, most Muslims I know would not say that. And I think we need to be careful that we do not put mouths in their words. This man, I think, I don't know what group he comes from. Certainly we have quite a few at Speaker's Corner that adhere to that, but they cannot show me anywhere in their scriptures where they're allowed to kill gays. They're allowed to lash them, but not kill them. Say again? Child molesters. There are references to yeah, I have to be careful here because it depends on what tradition you're going to go through. Like say the verse on Rajam. Rajam is a verse on stoning for all adulterers. Now, if you look in the Quran today, that verse is not there. But if you go to Al-Bukhari, for instance, and you ask and you find when in I think it's volume 4416, if you look in his volume, you will see that he talks about stoning and he talks about rajam, and he even has a reference there to Umar, who bemoans the fact that they no longer stone the adulterers. And he says, what's going to happen when they read the book, they read the Quran, and they realize that the Prophet stoned, we stoned after him, and yet there's no longer any verse on stoning today. It is now 100 lashes. So there is a reference, there are references, even in the traditions, to capital punishment. Whether or not these who adhere to the stoning of in your case, you're talking about the homosexuals, if they do say that, you need to ask them to source it. And I don't find many sources for that. And if they are sources, they tend to be very weak hadith. So the vast majority of Muslims I come across do not and would never adhere to that. And many of them just tend to be ignorant. Now, that's not to say that people don't do that. I mean, there's that famous scene in that Behind the Veil, or not Behind the Veil, that documentary that was done last year in Afghanistan with the Taliban, where the leader of Vice and Virtue was saying, we are a religion of peace. And the next question is, what are you going to do with the homosexuals? Well, of course, we killed them. Almost in the same breath. So how do you deal with somebody who says we're religion peace that kills them, and yet he is an authority in his own country? I would also, in that situation, ask him where his source, where his authority for doing that. Because there aren't many places you can go for authority for that. And to be fair, we need to be careful that we do take them back to the authority, that we do hold and we hold true to that, so we do not conceptualize, perceive something that's not there. Telephone. What did you do about telephone? What was the question again? Cold turkey, yes. What are you going to do about cold turkey calls? I think the best thing to do, and I find I have no problem, because whether it's on the telephone or even meeting a Muslim in their group or on the street, I just tell them, listen, I believe the Bible is the Word of God. What do you think about that? And I'll start a conversation for 2 hours. They're the greatest people in the world to get into a conversation, because they're not scared to talk about their faith. And they're not scared to talk about your faith. That's why I think they're the most engaging people. I think it's so good to have people that have passion like that. I love that passion. So don't worry about it. You don't have to dangle a carrot in front of their eyes. Just say, what do you think about the Trinity?
Jay, the longest ongoing family feud is Isaac and Ishmael, which eventually become the Arab-Israeli conflict. You know, here you have Abraham and then Ishmael, and Ishmael mocking Isaac, and then later... you know, once he's banished, he's the son of Hagar. And then you have biblically, through the Ishmaelites taking even Joseph, which is quite interesting, down to Egypt. But then you lose sight of them. You hear about them in the Bible again later with the Ishmaelites are called the Midianites, and the Midianites are the Ishmaelites. But then after that, biblically, you kind of lose track of them. The question is really, do they become the ultimate, progenitors of the Arab people and Saudi Arabia in particular, the nation? And if so, ultimately also the progenitor of Muhammad. Is that sort of the line? Or, you know, there's a Christian apologist in America, I think it's Robert Morey, that argues that, in fact, if you look at Arab history before Muhammad, there was no mention of Ishmael, and that they tried to tag along him with him and get the blessings that Ishmael was supposed to get. So I don't know how you would argue one way or the other.
Yeah, I would say a number of things here. First and foremost, I think we need to go with what they say. If they believe that Muhammad is the line of Ishmael, we need to accept that. However they're going to prove that, though they may bend over backwards trying to find some historical substantiation for that, or they don't find it, I think they think, and I think it's important that they assume that that is the case. For Morey to say that there is no reference to Ishmael before that, I think in Arabia, I think he has to be careful, because there's lots of references to Ishmaelites and Hagarites. We find documentation that goes back to the 4th century AD referring to these people living in Arabia. And certainly for Muhammad to claim to be an Ishmaelite is perfectly acceptable. And if you look at the 7th century inscriptions by Theodoretus and Cosmas, they refer to Ishmaelites in their references in the 5th and 6th century. And we have some disputations that are put together in the 7th and 8th century that refers to these people as Ishmaelites. So there's lots of references to people who are Ishmaelites who come from the Arab nations. How are we going to deal with that as Christians? I think we need to take them back to our scriptures. I think we need to show what it says there in Genesis 17. When Abraham asked the same question, you know, what are you going to do with my son Ishmael? What about him? And God turns to him and says, I will bless your son Ishmael, and from him will come many nations. And that's true. We see many nations have come from him. I'm willing to go with that. But you need to read the next verse. Because then he says, but my covenant is with Isaac. And that's really substantiated, again, a few chapters in Genesis 22, where then he goes to Abraham, and not once, not twice, but three times he tells Abraham to take his one and unique son, Isaac. Now, God knew he had more than one son. He didn't. He knew his arithmetic, and certainly he knew that Ishmael was living at that time. Why did he not refer to him and include him? Because as far as God was concerned, Abraham only had one son, because that's the son that he provided. Okay? And what's great is then you can go right to Galatians 4 and show how Paul then takes that and shows then the conflict between those who come from the slave woman, Hagar, and those who come from the free woman, Sarah, that we are to be people of the free woman, not of the slave woman. Now, that's a great application of how we can use that today, going back to our scriptures and showing how it was founded, of course, how it was begun right there at the very beginning. But no, let's be careful that we do not take that which they say and throw it in their face. I think we need to accept the fact that they do believe Muhammad is one of the Ishmaelites. But one of the things you can also do is say, look at your own Quran and name me any prophets there. Name any of the prophets in the Quran. And you'll find every one of the prophets come in the line of Isaac. Not one of them comes in the line of Ishmael. So it's obvious to me, even the Quran stipulates that the prophethood is in the line of Isaac. And if you still have any doubt, go to Surah 29, 27, where it even stipulates the line of prophethood is in the line of Isaac. Now, that's not the only line, because then there's others that also contradict that. But it still says, from this line of prophet is the line of Isaac. So it's great to have these aids, these bridges that you can use to get into that discussion.
Great. Thanks, Jay. Can I ask one more quick question? One more quick.
Go ahead.
The issue of what's in it for paradise for women of Islam. In other words, the issue is if a man would go and do jihad, the Quran would stipulate, as far as the verses I've read, surahs I've read, that you would actually get many companions, many virgins that would never age, that be black-eyed beauties, and you could have anything that's not forbidden with them, with goblets and cushions and recliners. But I heard one lady tell me, she said, well, that would be hell for me. You know, I mean, a room full of naked women. I mean, what is it in it for? What's paradise or heaven or their creation after this? What's in it for a woman?
That's hard for me to answer as a male. I would like women to ask other women this. In fact, on our team, we have women actually go and pose this question to Islamic women, to Muslim women, to find out how they would deal with that. What I have heard, and what Muslim women do tell me when I do ask that on occasion, is that the Houthis, those Houthis that are waiting for them, where they come from, who they are, it cannot be answered. They certainly are not the women that are here on this earth. They are created for that purpose. What we do need to do is go back to Bukhari again and go back to the traditions. Because there you have quite a number. In fact, I've got a good five or six, and there's more than that, that I've already come across, that refer to an incident where Muhammad goes to heaven. And when he goes to heaven, he sees that the majority of those in heaven are men. And then when he goes to hell, he sees the majority of those in hell are women. So Muhammad himself even shows that as far as he's concerned, the majority of those that are waiting for him, that are going to be there, are going to be men. So this is a difficulty for many women, because most Muslim women have not read Bukhari. They don't go back to their traditions. They're not aware of this. Also, they've not read Surah 55 and Surah 56, which is what you're referring to, because those two surahs give an image of heaven. And it's a heaven that, though I find it's a very carnal environment, it's not an environment that really entices me, even as a male. Sorry, women, but I'm not really interested in wine, women, and song. Because what I'm waiting for in heaven is not to have women there. I'm waiting to be walking and talking with my Lord again. I can't wait to get there. I want to make sure that I take as many people along with me so they can be walking and talking with their Lord. Because as far as I'm concerned, you can get an Islamic heaven at Las Vegas. And I don't want to just give them Las Vegas. I want to make sure that I'm going to be there with my Lord. And it's not just going to be a garden with fruit and a garden with rivers of water and wine. It's going to be a place that I'm going to be with my Lord for eternity. The very thing that Adam and Eve had at the very beginning, I want to see at the very end. But interestingly, and this is what you need to say, and you need to find out, if you go back to the Garden of Eden in the Quran, in Surah 2, in Surah 7, in Surah 20, when you look at the image of the Garden of Eden in the Quran, you will find that God is not walking in that garden. God is not in that garden. So if he is not there at the very beginning, he won't be there at the very end. So if it's only a carnal heaven at the very beginning, it's going to be a carnal heaven at the very end. So you can see where they got it wrong. If you don't have God in the garden, walking and talking with Adam and Eve in the cool of the day, relating to them in that relationship there, then of course you're not going to have it at the very end. So until you get that right, until you go back and get your foundations right, and you need to discuss this with them, you can see that they have nothing more than what you would expect man, not women, man to want. and it's missing the most important ingredients.
This may be a somewhat ignorant question, but can you, I've heard a lot of people, probably as many non-Muslims as Muslims, I don't even know if I've actually heard a Muslim say this, but non-Muslims will say to me, well, it's all the same God. And I've heard that refuted by Christians, that Allah is not the same God that we worship, even though they're, it's coming, I think, from Ishmael. But can you kind of explain to me what the difference, or is there a difference in not our interpretation of God, but is there a real difference between the person of Allah and the person of our God?
Wow, yes. I mean, this is one of my, I love to talk about this because I have to do it all the time when I'm trying to interpret for Muslims who my God is. Now, there are many people that use the word Allah, even Christians that use the word Allah. So we need to be careful. Certainly many of the Arab Muslims, I'm sorry, Arab Christians in the Arab world use that name. But when they do use that name, they have to make sure that they put a meaning, a biblical meaning to it. And that's difficult because you don't always have the time to do so. So there is a confusion. There is an implicit confusion whenever we use Allah. So therefore, I just don't use that anymore. In some ways, it's been taken care of for us because places like Malaysia, they know Christians may no longer use the name Allah. So what name are you going to use? Well, why not go back to the biblical name that's right there? Why not use Yahweh or Jehovah? Why not go back to God's personal name? Because that's pregnant with meaning for me. However, when I look at Allah, I think we need to realize if you do an orthographical study on the word itself, it's very similar to Elohim, the highest. Elohim, the highest, is also in Hebrew. It's a generic name for God, nothing more. Like God is in English for us. I want to know what God's personal name is. I want to know the name that I can use that distinguishes him from all others. Now, we've done orthographical studies on this word itself, and we realize that the name it actually comes from a pre-Islamic pagan origin, and that it has a pantheon, belongs to a pantheon of gods. Hubal, who is above him, and three daughters of Allah, Alat, Al-Manat, and Al-Uzza, the same three daughters, the same three names that are found in Surah 53, which are part of what we know as the satanic verses. Now, this is incredulous to me that they've incorporated a pre-Islamic pagan name that belongs to a pantheon, because if they desire a monotheistic God, then what are they doing borrowing a polytheistic, bringing it from a polytheistic origins? That in and of itself shows that they have not done their own studies, but most Muslims have not done a historical study on that name. But as far as the character of God, then of course you get huge differences. Because my God over here, if you look at who my God is, he comes down and walks and talks with Adam and Eve. He comes down and sups with Abraham in front of the tent of Mamre. He comes down and wrestles with Jacob. He comes down and is in the pillar of fire at night and the pillar of cloud during the day to lead the Israelites. He comes down and in the burning bush in front of Moses comes and talks to him. So my God comes down all the time and relates to me. All the right through the history we see these theophanies, but more so my God comes down. And for 33 years, 2,000 years ago, he not only comes and walks and talks amongst those of us who were there at that time, but he dies for me. Now, in that right up there, you can see an enormous difference. See, God over on this side, for Islam, is distant. He's omnipotent, omniscient, and omnipresent. All the three omnis, certainly he is all of that. But he does not come down and relate to his creation. He will not come down and never has come down and is in relationship with his creation, as my God is. So if just from that point alone, you can see how the ramifications of that are enormous. If God does not come down and relate with Adam and Eve at the very beginning, then therefore you're not going to understand what the incarnation is. You're not going to understand what atonement's about. You'll have no idea, therefore, what happened 2,000 years ago. You'll not even understand why God chose to do that and why he stipulated that there in Genesis 3:15, where we have the first prophecy of how he's going to rectify the very problem that existed because of the sin that came into the world because of the sin of Adam and Eve. The very same sin that I see in Surah 2 and 7 and 20. But that sin is forgiven. End of story. Yet they're thrown out of the Garden of Eden. I don't understand why they're thrown out of the Garden of Eden in the Islamic account if they're already forgiven. Why aren't Adam and Eve still in the Garden of Eden? I can only understand that when I understand who God is. When I go to Psalm 77:13 or Psalm 99:9 or I go to Habakkuk 1:13, I realize that God, because of his holiness, cannot look upon sin. Now, my God is so holy, he cannot look upon sin. Therefore, because we are sinful, we have to be eradicated from his presence. How am I going to get back into relationship with him? God provides a solution. It did right there in verse 15 of chapter 3. So that's my God who woos me and takes care of the problem and rectifies it. He rectifies it because he knows I can't rectify it because I'm dead. We're all dead. Now, that's a kind of God that's distinctly different from Allah, who does not come and do anything with his creation, does not relate to them, has to use intermediaries to even communicate with them, never comes and loves those who do not love him, only loves those who love him to begin with. It's a conditional love. My God loves those who even hate him. It's unconditional. So you can go on and on and do comparative, right back and forth, showing the differences between the character of God and also the difference between the actions of God. And then, of course, the major difference is I know where I'm going to be on the other side of death. I'm going to be with my God again. Certainly they would. They would say it's a God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. However, by saying that, they're mimicking what their traditions say. They have to say that. But he is intrinsically not the God that I see in my scriptures. He's not the God that I see, not only evidenced from the whole history of the Jewish nation, but the God that has come down in the personhood of Jesus Christ. So therefore, I have to make the distinction, and I have to make sure that I define who my God is to the Muslim and to myself to begin with. Okay?
Hello, hi. I am an American Muslim. I was born in this country, raised in this country, and I acknowledge that you do have vast knowledge of the Quran as well as the Bible, and I just had a couple of comments as well as questions for you. One was the three types of Muslims and the characterizations that you named them into, the far right, the nominal, and the assimilated. I don't see that as representative of Muslims at all whatsoever. Just as in Christianity or Judaism, you do have people who have vast knowledge of the religion, Orthodox or, you know, those type of people, and then you do have people who aren't well-versed in the religion, but in terms of percentages, I don't think that's a fair characteristic to say that of Muslims at all whatsoever. I don't think that they're nominal Muslims in terms of, oh, well, they don't really have too much education, and yes, they just do believe everything verbatim or anything like that. In terms of Muslims in North America, yes, there are vast schools, and that majority of Muslims are raised to go to Sunday schools. There are many schools, especially within Southern California, and organizations. I, for one, represent the Council on American Islamic Relations, and I also am aware of the Council on Islamic Education that's here in the Southern California, as well as the Muslim Public Affairs Council. And so I wanted to make that point clear at first. And another thing, you mentioned Islamic art and literature and how Islam is opposed to that, but that's actually quite a contradiction, knowing that there's many examples of Islamic art that's given throughout the world and it can be witnessed anywhere. You go into a mosque or a Muslim institution or, you know, a place of worship, and philosophers that were known as Muslims, you know, they're some of the oldest philosophers were Muslim philosophers. I wanted to point that out as well. And in terms of violence and your character saying that in terms of Islam, well, what about, you know, just to play the devil's advocate, Christian fundamentalists and bombing of abortion clinics, or actions such as the Oklahoma City bombing committed by Timothy McVeigh, or, you know, other points in history. I mean, I feel that, yes, you are bringing up examples of people who are Muslim that, you know, claim to be Muslim and are implementing terrorist actions. Yet, yes, I am going to say that, and I agree, Islam is derived from the word of peace in Arabic, and it is a religion of peace. And that I see that within any example, you can point out any group of people and say, yes, there are radicals that defy the normal beliefs of that religion. And you can go on to say that as well. And in terms of the Israeli and Palestinian issue, I am going to point out that, yes, our government does give $22 billion a year to that country to, you know, assist in the genocide of those people. Right now, as of to date, 6 out of 8 Palestinian territories are illegally being occupied by Israeli troops in Palestine right now. And that's a fact. You know, I can corroborate that with any news article based on U.S. media or any other type. And yes, that the U.S. is opposed to that right now. And, you know, I can go on and on about this.
But let me just answer some of those real quickly. Mm-hmm. Getting back to the first of all, how we define what Islam is. I think we're always going to have a problem with that. These are just generalities done by Dr. Philip Lewis in U.K. And in the U.K., they have been accepted by the Muslim community there as being accurate. Obviously, within the nominal group, there's huge variations. And almost everybody you talk to will follow somewhere right or left along that line. But in order to understand why we're dealing with, who we're dealing with, we have to be able to put in generalities. We do the same thing with Christians. We also try to come up with figures to see who is nominal, who are religious right, who is the moral majority, whatever name you want to give to them. And for that reason, it will probably jar you to hear this because you're not aware of it, because you're not in UK, you don't hear it, you don't see it, or you don't read the same books that I do. As I said, and I made a disclaimer, I don't know what it is for United States. I would think it's similar since we come from the same similar backgrounds and you have similar types of Muslims here as we do in the UK. I could be totally wrong. You can tell me better on that than others. As far as what were some of the other the situations you're talking about? Just give me the names. Just
the types of abortion clinics.
Okay, what are we going to do with violence? I will do with violence what I've always done. I think I have to be consistent. If anybody uses violence, I will condemn it. I will condemn the Timothy McVeighs. I will condemn the Crusades. Mm-hmm. Why do I condemn it? Because my Lord Jesus Christ condemned it. And therefore, I have to use it as my paradigm. But if you're going to condemn it, mm-hmm. then are you willing to also condemn what your prophet did in Medina?
I think the same thing as a historical context. You need to look at the time frame and discuss that. And you need to
okay,
say,
can you tell me then, why did he eradicate the Jews in Medina?
If you're defining jihad, which is true, it means striving in the way of God. But there are certain rules and regulations in terms of warfare about when you need to use them. I mean, when Islam is against the killing of innocent civilians, for the women, children, and those who are unarmed, and is in terms of warfare, when you're being oppressed for your religion, for your property, or when your family is in danger, you are able to use that. And it's not like, okay, well, you're going to go ahead and accept, you know, oppression that's being put against you.
Okay, let me stop you right there. Let me ask you, who was oppressing Muhammad Medina? Which Jews were oppressing Muhammad Medina? When he had control of the economy at that time, he had total political control. Who was oppressing Muhammad in 624? When they were moving up in the month of Ramadan, the month of peace, those 900 Meccans. Who was oppressing who there? Who was oppressing Muhammad when, not just Muhammad, but Umar, when he moved right across North Africa and eradicated the churches there, conquered not only the Sassanid Empire, but the Byzantine Empire, starting what not only with Damascus, moving right across into Spain, moving up into France and finally being stopped in France in 732 by Charles Martel. Who was oppressing who? So I think it's very careful that you need to go back and read your own history. You need to go back and read your own traditions. Nobody was oppressing Muhammad or his those who came after him, certainly within the rightly guided caliphs. We don't see any account, no documentation whatsoever, of anybody attacking the Muslims at that point.
I think that during that time, too, people were allowed to worship the religion in which they were worshiping. There was no compulsion.
You haven't answered my question. Why is it that he attacked the Meccans, who were moving from Mecca up, going up to Gaza in the month of Ramadan? Why did he attack them?
I'm not an Islamic scholar.
Okay, that's fine. Read your own history, and before you can before you use these examples to condemn me, make sure that you're willing to condemn that which is in your own traditions. Because I don't find Muslims doing that. And I think it's important that if you're going to stand up and substantiate and say that Muhammad is a man of peace, you've got to go look at his Siratul Rasulullah. Have you read the Siratul Rasulullah? Are you familiar with what he did with Asma, the poetess?
I have examples, but I mean, I'm not, you know, like, okay. As you said, I'm not educated.
Okay, and I shouldn't really throw these at you right here in this audience. But it's important that Muslims are able to be self-critical. Mm-hmm. I don't see Muslims doing that.
Jane, why don't we give her the last brief word
and we'll move on to another question. Okay. I mean, and my final comment would be that I hope when we have this type of forum that we do have an Islamic scholar that's present that can able to answer these questions, you know, and can, you know, substantiate or claim, you know, ayahs that you're using and source that you're using and that, you know,
yeah,
sunnah
that's only
that you're
fair.
Referring to. I mean, I only feel there's only one perspective that's being, you know, claimed. And I think that just anyone else in this room, I don't think that not everyone here is considered a scholar in terms of Christianity. And that, you know, they're able to claim as much as you have.
Well, I did answer on my point. I think it's very important that as Christians we do condemn it. Whenever anybody, especially Christians, mm-hmm. use violence, we have to condemn it.
Yeah, and
because my Lord Jesus Christ would condemn it.
I condemn the attacks that happened on September 11th. I am mourned just as everybody else mourned in this country.
And you are
but
genuine. I can
so
see that.
So are Muslims in this country that have been victims of hate crimes. Yeah. How do you justify that, saying that there are people out there that
I would not
you
justify
know, are doing that, are committing hundreds of acts of violence against these people, that people have been killed, people of different groups as well. So, I mean, that's the same
okay, one last question.
That was pretty much it. And then I was talking about many the different forms of jihad that you were mentioning. And so...
Yeah, I think I did mention that there's actually three forms of jihad. One is striving within yourself, and that's what they are trying to bring into Britain with the Hizb ut-Tahrir party, is trying to really mm-hmm. foment that. One is striving against Satan so that you will not be influenced by him. And then the third form would be striving in the cause of Allah. Okay. Qital, what they call it. Okay.
Hi. Wow, you're really awesome. It's a way to deflate me.
I was sitting next to her, actually, so I got to talk to her as well. I was wondering, I was looking in the Middle Eastern region, and I was clicking on the internet just at what predominant religions are in that area, and most of them are like 90% or above Muslim. What was curious to me was, why is it that a place where Jesus was born and a place where Jews were at one time, I don't know, prosperous, why is it that it's now predominantly Muslim? Is it because of political oppression, just that, I guess, like politics took over and Muslims were supposed to worship Islam, but or like, I don't know, how do you explain the predominant Muslim in the Middle Eastern?
I think I've already answered that. And if you look at the historical map in the 7th century, that was almost what we call the 7th century conquest. All that whole part of the world, Basra in 637, Baghdad in 638 was conquered. Damascus was conquered also in 638. Jerusalem was conquered in 641, and then coming on down to Cairo in 640. So within 10 years of Muhammad's death, you have the five major cities, the five metropolitan areas of that world were conquered and brought under their jurisdiction. From that time until today, they have predominated. And as we well know from the whole history of the last 1,400 years, we see that Islam has always eradicated cultures wherever it dominates. It eradicates them not only structurally, but also eradicates them politically and certainly religiously. And so as a result of that, there has not been any opposition, certainly not any religious opposition. We know that very well for any of us who want to go as missionaries to Muslim countries today. We cannot go as missionaries. We are not permitted to propagate our faith. We do not have the freedom to build churches in those countries. And much of that has been there for 1,400 years. It's something that's not just new in the 21st century. It's been there since the inception of Islam. But it started with the conquests. And I find it curious why that we today flagellate ourselves and we justifiably condemn ourselves for what we did in the Crusades. That needs to be condemned. I have a friend in London who did a study and found out that since 1975 there have been 245 books written by Europeans or Westerners against the Crusades. Only two books have been written on the Crusade, on the conquest, the Islamic conquest in the same time period. I find that curious. Because I think there needs to be reciprocity. I think we need to be able to, it's at the same time, if we're going to question our own history, if we're going to condemn our own history, we must ask Muslims to do the same with their own history. And I do not see Muslims doing that. I see them trying to excuse it all the time, but I do not see them willing to condemn it when it needs to be condemned.
Thank you.
I can stay around afterwards if other people want to come and ask me.
Thanks, Jay. My name's Wayne Anoshta, and you might have covered this in your opening statements, but maybe just to clarify, is it possible for an average Muslim citizen to distinguish between a fight against terrorism and a fight against those who are unbelievers of Allah? And I guess coupled with that, then, is, you know, if we're courting nations that are Muslim in makeup, what's going to happen with our so-called revolution that's coming in support of people like bin Laden? You know, what are we looking at?
Okay, I can't answer that question wholly. I can only say that what is happening certainly with Afghanistan is that in many ways that's very misguided. For one thing, Afghanistan's not the problem. Afghanistan, the Taliban themselves, as I think I said earlier, don't belong in Afghanistan. They are seen as a foreign power. They are Pashtuns. If you look at the map, you will see that when the British and the Russians carved up that part of the world, they drew a line right through the Pashtun tribe. Half of it was in Afghanistan, the other half was in Pakistan. And since the time of their creation, the northern part of Pakistan has birthed an awful lot of what we call madrasas. These are schools where they are trained, and they are trained in this very radical fundamentalist thought. And it's in those madrasas that the Talibes means the disciples or students. The students have come out of those madrasas, and then they are the ones that have taken over Afghanistan. So if we even do eradicate the Taliban, if it is so, and maybe it will be so, because we certainly sooner or later we will defeat them, where do you think they're going to go? They're going to just go south of the border, back to those madrasas, back to northern Pakistan, back to a country that has 150 million Muslims who are already being radicalized. There is where the big problem lies. And I don't think we've begun to scratch the issue of what happens when Pakistan becomes radicalized and fundamental, especially if there is a coup, if there is a civil war there. and this 60 to 7 million Muslims take over the government. Now, remember, this government has a nuclear bomb. We've not even begun to think of what the ramifications of that are. Now, what a terrible note to end on. Just remember, God is sovereign, and he knows what he's doing. But that's all the more should give us the impetus to get in this battle, because we are the only people that have the answer. It's not going to come through bombs, bullets, cruise missiles. It's got to come from the model that we know, and that's the Lord Jesus Christ. Okay.